Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of Apartment Investing for Early Retirement. I am your host, Derek Loda, and with me today is Bill Hamm. Bill is the owner-operator of Phoenix Residential Group and Phoenix Residential Management. He's been in the real estate business for 13 years and has created a portfolio of over 1,000 units while growing Phoenix Management to a team of 15 staff members. He has taught real estate for the past 6 years and has dozens of highly successful investor students. Bill uses his extensive real estate experience to teach his students the real side of real estate. Without further ado, welcome, Bill. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So we'll just jump right into it. Obviously, we have your bio, but would you mind just giving a little bit of a background on your story, what got you into multifamily, and maybe a little bit of what you've learned along the way?
Yeah, well, how much time do you have? I've actually been in the business about 15 years now. I need to update that bio. So been doing it about 15 years. I am a corporate pilot by trade. Came out of school, started flying airplanes, and realized that I liked flying airplanes. I just didn't like being told when and where to fly airplanes. That's part I didn't like. But the flying was great. So I closed in 2004. Late 2004, I closed my very first deal. It was a duplex. And I had saved up about $10,000 a month. I had saved up about $10,000. The duplex was cash flowing about $300 a month. And I turned in my 2-week notice and walked away from the aviation career with $10,000 and $300 a month income on my duplex. I never looked back. For better or for worse, I'm still here. But had some ups, had some downs, survived all of them. Fast forward, I've now joined up with a good friend of mine and partner, Tony Morgan, and we formed Broadwell Property Group. So that's our company going forward now is BPG, Broadwell Property. Yep, that's awesome. Where I'm at today.
Awesome. So, you know, with looking at multifamily versus, you know, other aspects of mm-hmm. it, why did you settle on this and, you know, What was really the big appeal?
Yeah, good question. The economy of scale is probably the most simple answer I can give you. I had gotten up to about 40 houses in rental houses. I mean, these were lower income type houses, so, you know, not 40 mansions or anything of that nature. But I did have 40 single family houses sort of in a portfolio at one point in time and realized that there was no real economy of scale. You know, every house was different. Every set of electrical was different. The plumbing was different. The location was different. So it really took a lot to manage a larger portion of houses. And so I realized the only way to get to real wealth or you know, creating real revenue was to set up a system that would be a little more on the professional side. And that's when I realized, that's multifamily. And I know now that I can manage a 100-unit apartment complex in the same amount of time I can manage about 10 houses. Because, you know, the 10 houses are all over the city. I've got to go here. I got to go there. The tenant's not home. They got to come back. Or I can have a 100-unit apartment complex where I can just put staff in the office. And then Bill doesn't have to manage anything. That's where I like it. That's when the business gets a lot more interesting. So for me, that's why I ultimately moved into multifamily was economy of scale.
Did you, like, right away when you started, did you have a third-party management or did you start your management company right away?
No, I didn't start the management company proper in the beginning, but I did start managing the buildings myself early on, largely just because I was poor. I had quit the job. I had no income. I had no money. You know, I really couldn't afford to hire a third-party management company. I needed that revenue for myself, so I started to learn to manage. I did that for a little while, and then I wound up hiring a management company. I've hired several ones over the years, and most of them didn't really do that well. And I thought, well, you know, I can do that all by myself. I don't need to pay somebody to do that. So I wound up just really sort of incorporating in 2009 and forming the actual entity that became Phoenix Management, that's Phoenix Management today. That's how I got here. So, yeah, I've been managing from the beginning, more or less.
Mm-hmm. What was the biggest thing from when you were managing your properties to when, you know, you formally started the management company for it? What was the biggest takeaway from it that, you know, you might not have seen from just having a third party management, like something to watch out for?
Yeah. You know, what I would recommend people watch out for is the time drain. That's something you probably don't see coming is everybody all thinks, well, I'm just gonna set up my own management company. I'm gonna make all this extra money and all these fees and all this. You're right. You are. at an extreme cost to your own personal time. So it really probably slowed my portfolio growth. So by managing my own assets, I made more money. My education was a lot more solid. My experience was a lot more solid. Yes, but I grew slower than friends of mine. They were hiring third-party management companies and were just strictly syndicating deals. I still feel like I wound up in the long run being better for being in the management company or in the management side, because as an operator, now I see value that other people don't see. You know, I know how to look at a set of books and I look at the operations of a company and say, ah, see, here's where they're going wrong and we can fix that. Therefore, this really is a good deal. And I found a lot of deals that were sort of hidden value because I'm an operator and I know how to look at it. So it has been good, but at the same time, it's not free. And then you get into managing real estate is not real estate. That's a whole other business. You're in a business now. You got staff, you got payroll, you got employees. That's not real estate. Let's be clear. That's people management. And that's not something everybody is cut out for, nor wants to sign up for. You know? So something to keep in mind. It's not free and easy. It's good. It's just not free and easy.
Yeah, really the only thing is, as a passive investor in deals, right. Then it's hands off. I mean, you have, your updates and stuff.
Yeah.
It's the level that you want to be.
Yeah. If you want to be a hands-off investor in real estate, write someone a check. Simple as that. Write me a check. I'll put it in one of my deals. I'll spend it for you. If you want to go out and do real estate on your own, it is anything but passive. Let me be very clear. You know, as I tell my students, passive real estate or passive revenue is probably one of the most labor-intensive types of revenue to create. And so people use this term passive revenue. Well, it is passive once you've built the company. Yeah, but building the company is not passive. You know what I mean? Investing in real estate, raising money, finding deals, talking, none of that is passive. And so I think that's a big misunderstanding that a lot of people have that are looking to get into this business, is that it is quick money. It's not. You're going to get rich quick. You're not. It's easy. It's no money down. It's none of those things. It is a great business. You can do it with other people's money. You can leverage. You can syndicate. You can do lots of things. You can get very wealthy. It's just not free and easy. Just be clear about that part. You better get ready to roll your sleeves up. You're building a company. No different than any other kind of company you might build.
Yeah, it's a business. It's not hands off. But again, if you go as a passive investor side, it can be. And what we're talking about that, how would you recommend that people who just want to be passive in it, or perhaps they want to just passively invest to start out, see what it's like, and then develop. Right. What are some things that they should maybe look out for kind of to vet a deal or a sponsor and know that's the right investment for them?
Yeah, absolutely. It's know your, as we say in this business, know your customer. You need to know your syndicator. You really need to vet that individual. What ideally, and this is a personal sales pitch, ideally what you would want to do is invest with someone who has been through the last recession. That's ideal. I have been through the last recession. I have survived. I've been through a full market cycle. I know what both sides look like. I've been tested. I made it. I'm still here. That makes me an infinitely safer bet than someone who is not. But that's easier said than done, because the majority of the syndicators in the market today have not ever seen a down market. So if you can't find a syndicator who has the down cycle experience, obviously I would look for someone who's been through a recession. If you can't find that person, then just make sure that what that individual is doing, their underwriting is not too aggressive, that they're not projecting that, you're going to refinance this deal and cash out all the equity and everybody gets all their money back. And, or that we're going to raise rents, some unreasonable amount of money, or that the whole deal only makes sense if we raise the rents and do these things. And if we don't, then the deal is a horrible deal. Don't invest in that deal. You want to invest in a deal that makes good, solid financial sense. And if it has upside to it, that's the cherry on top. That's extra. But don't make the deal strictly about one sort of exit, one strategy. I think that would be risky. But for a general individual looking to get into the business as an LP, it's a lot more about the people than the deal, really. If you've got good people that know what they're doing, most of the deals can be dealt with. If you have people that don't know what they're doing, or you have people that are willing to be unscrupulous in their business, you're probably going to lose money regardless of what that deal does. So it's really about the people.
So say someone who's looking, they want to get into it, they want to get into the active side, the sponsoring of deals, they're new, they haven't been through that recession, they haven't been through that cycle. What would be some advice for them for how to kind of align or be able to watch out for that?
Yeah, step one, get an education. You know, you've been a part of a program, as have I. I strongly recommend that you go out and find a multifamily educator that speaks to you and that you like and that you have vetted. Same thing, make sure that they're not con artists. And be willing to spend a little bit of money on an education. That's one of the best things you can do is get a coach. You know, there are good books. There's lots of different things you can do. You can go to Bigger Pockets. You can listen to the podcasts and the posts. All that's wonderful. You know, come to podcasts just like this one. You know, and you can gather a lot of organic information, but you still need someone to help you bring it all together and someone who has experience to help you navigate the beginnings of this business. You're gonna let me put it like this: it's tuition. You're going to pay it to a teacher or you're going to pay it to the deal. One of the two, you know what I mean? Wherever you want to spend your money at, it's fine. You are going to learn. You're either going to learn through those mistakes, which can be big and devastating, or you're going to learn by paying someone to stop you from making those big mistakes. However you want to spend your money, I recommend the teacher personally. But when I got started, I did not have a coach. I did not have a teacher. And I got out on the street and just made it up. And I made it up wrong a lot of the times. I really screwed it up a lot. So it just depends on how thick your skin is. But I seriously recommend finding a good mentor that walks you through this.
Yeah, rather to spend the money up front than to spend it in the middle of the deal.
You'll spend it somewhere.
You're going to learn eventually. So
yeah, exactly. Again, you're going to learn somehow. That's
you're
right.
Always going to pay tuition. But yeah, so – you know, again, for people that are looking into finding deals today, what are some key metrics that investors should look at with where we're at in the market cycle? Obviously, each market is at a different point in the cycle, but just as a whole, what would be some things to kind of look at?
As a whole, let me tell you more of what my business strategy is. I am staying away from aging assets. That's what I'm kind of warning the average person. Let me kind of go into preacher mode for a second here. This is the first time in American history that the largest majority of our apartments have gotten to the age that they are now. If you look at the general construction of multifamily, and I don't mean quads and duplexes, I mean the larger 50, 100 unit, 200 unit apartment complexes, the bigger apartment complexes, those all seem to really come into existence in the early 1960s. 1961, 1962, 1963, there seemed to be a big growth spurt in the multifamily industry. And so the 1960s product is the baseline of our affordable housing in America right now. Yeah, but those properties are getting to be about 70 years old. They're starting to fail on the infrastructure side, plumbing, subflooring, crawl space, the wood, you know, you've got 70 years worth of moisture and the pipes are now brittle and 70 years old. This is the first time in American history the large portion of our multifamily has reached that age. It's never been a problem before. So if you talk to people that were in the business for the last 20, 30 years, they're going to tell you I'm crazy. Right, because plumbing was out of sight, out of mind for 30 years. But today, that old plumbing is collapsing. And so what I'm suggesting, long-winded answer, is that we have a flight to quality. So for my business and my partner and here at Broadwell Property Group, what we're doing is we're moving towards the B assets and the B to A areas, newer construction. And I say newer, I say 1985 or newer, B assets, A areas. And let's just have that flight to quality because I believe that is the best hedge against a recession. I've been through some market cycles and some of the mistakes I made in some of the other market cycles were to buy lower end assets, you know, that they were only desirable when the market was super hot. And when the market wasn't super hot anymore, people were not really that interested in that kind of junky real estate. And I lost a lot of money like that. And so what happened were loans came due and I didn't really have a lot of options and I kind of got in financial trouble. So what I realized from that recession, if you have a quality building, you can refinance that thing almost anywhere. You can sell it almost anytime. If you have low-end real estate, you only sell those at the height of the market. So if we know we're going to go into a cooling off period or even a full-on recession, I think quality of asset is going to be the safest hedge against that. And that's why, you know, as I said here at BBG, we're moving our assets up to the higher level. We protect our investors, you know, because most of my deals are syndicated. My partner and I syndicate our deals. And so our number one point is to make sure our investors make money. You know, we sort of follow three core values. One is to serve the community, serve the property. And third is to serve the investor. Well, you know, if we take care of the asset and it's in a good area and we take care of the community around the building, the investors make money. That's easy. That's no problem, right? So that's kind of how we take our model is to serve the property and the area first. Well, that means we're buying quality assets in quality areas. And that's our safety net. So that's what I recommend to everybody here is be careful about those old buildings and let's look at quality. Hey, the market's super hot. If you're going to overpay for something, let's at least overpay for something good. You know what I mean? Don't overpay for junk. Wrong time for that.
And I think, you know, from what I've been seeing, a lot of that stuff that's those 60s, 70s build versus the mid 80s getting into the 90s build, it's not that much different in those cap rates and what the rates are for it. So,
and there's a hidden problem there. You're absolutely right. The cap rate between the B+ and the C- is very negligible. But the C- is going to have capital expense items you're not budgeting for. So really, there's no the spread is even, you know, less than you think and maybe even inverted. Because if you go in and you say, well, here's a C asset built in 1965 and it's selling at a 6 cap rate. I'm telling you, it's really probably a 3 cap rate once you go and replace the plumbing that you didn't realize you needed to replace. Once you replace the roofs, you didn't know needed to be replaced. You know, once you just get stuck on what I call a capital expense treadmill, you know, and all of a sudden you're stuck. It's like a bad credit card. You're just making that payment every month. You can't get off. You know, it's plumbing this month, and then it's the roof, and then it's the air conditioning. Oh my God, that's all your cash flow. And so really, that's an illusion cap rate. If you go buy the B+ property, it's not going to have all those surprise expenses, and you buy it at a 6 cap rate, it probably really is a 6 cap rate. The old C building is a hidden 3 that you think is a 6 because all that infrastructure stuff is going to explode and you're not going to get the cash flow you're expecting. That's the hidden problem with that cap rate compression and the very small delta between the C's and the A's as far as cap rate's concerned. So if there's a small spread, why don't I just go buy an A? Why buy a C when I'm not much difference between an A and a C, right? Just give me the A. At least it's new. At least I don't have to worry about the repairs. At least that's been my philosophy.
Yeah, just all of the non-glamorous capital expenses that you can't improve rent by replacing some pipes.
Correct, exactly. And here's the problem. This is what I call pencil whipping. Everybody wants to pencil whip the deal. You know, it's real easy to make those deals look like they're going to make a whole lot of money on paper. Right, but when you actually got to go over there and deal with that property and the plumbing and the roofs and everything else to make that money, that's where people will find a shock, you know, that those older buildings are a little more to deal with than you thought. And it looked great on paper, but that's an illusion.
And it's like you said, too, just going into it, kind of know what that exit's going to be. Those 90s assets, there's going to be a lot more buyers for it than a 60s asset, no matter what you do to it. So,
and a lot more lenders. And see, there's the key. If your loan comes due or you need to exit, there's infinitely more chance that you're going to find another lender and be able to refinance and have a safety net as opposed to a lender pulling back and saying, we don't want to renew your mortgage. And now you're stuck. And now you're forced into a sale or you're forced into some kind of exit. There's an old adage in real estate. You make money when you don't have to sell. You know, basically, if you're a motivated seller, motivated seller and profit are not usually in the same sentence, right? We're looking for motivated sellers. We're not looking to be motivated sellers. We're looking to find them, right? Because a motivated seller brings us the best deal. So you want to just avoid being a motivated seller, which means you've got a solid exit strategy and you don't get forced into an exit that you weren't planning on. That's the trick. And people love to say that you make money in real estate when you buy. I disagree completely. I think it's a horrible comment. You may create value when you buy. You make money when you put that check in the bank account. When you exit and the check clears and it's in the account, okay, now you've made money. ask anybody that ever went into foreclosure if they made money when they bought. They did not. It's a crap statement. You know what I mean? And it lends you to ignore exit strategy. That's the kiss of death in this business. So do not get arrogant and think you're making money because you're buying real estate. You are not. You might create value, but remember, you've still got to get out of that deal profitably. Then you can claim that you've made money.
And I think that's something too that, you know, since the recession, everything's been going so well, you know, for the most part. There's still been people that have gotten in
hard to make mistakes these days.
But yeah, just look out for it coming up. And, you know, to touch, you mentioned with the debt, you know, what are some things that you kind of have going for how you pair your debt with where we're at in the market cycle?
Okay, that's actually sort of what I call the three pillars of real estate investing. And that's, we don't have time for me to completely cover that subject. Maybe we'll do another one. We'll go through that whole subject.
Yeah,
we'll
brief here.
Yeah, right. Three pillars of real estate investing. Basically, those are the three things that you must time and get accurate to continue to be profitable in the business. That's market cycle, exit strategy, debt. And if you know your market cycle, you know where we are, the up, down, you know, we're going flat, are we going into recession? Then you know, and you know what your exit strategy is. Okay, we're at the top, we're going to flip. We're at the top, we're going to hold and operate, whatever the case. Then you go and get debt that matches the market and the exit. So for example, today, if we believe, and I believe that we are more or less at the top of a market cycle, that means the next cycle is going to be sort of a down cycle. What I don't want to do is to have a mortgage come due in the bottom of a recession, in a trough, because my values may be lower there. And if my mortgage comes due and I have to refinance or sell and the appraisals are down, I might find myself pinched. So what I want to do right now and what I recommend for everyone is that, first of all, let me back up. You need to understand that market cycles tend to run about 8 to 10 years, top to top, bottom to bottom. All right. So if we think that we're at the top, we can reasonably expect the next cycle, like it is today, to be about 10 years from now, 8 years from now or so. So what I want to do is not to have mortgages reset. So all the deals I want to do, I want to go get 7-year debt, 10-year debt, long-term debt, not 2-year, not 3-year, because that comes due, you know, in a potential recession, and that's where you may get yourself in trouble. So you want to do short-term loans like we've done over the last 5-6 years, as you pointed out, the market getting better and better and better. That's time for short-term loans, because then you can get in, out, flip, and you don't have a lot of prepayment penalties. But that's risky. You don't want to start doing short-term loans in a downslide because you'll literally catch the falling knife, right? So I'm suggesting everybody move to quality assets, plan for a longer-term hold window. You're probably going to hold assets about 5 to 7 years right now if you buy one today. And I recommend getting about 7 to 10-year debt so that you've got a nice, long, stable runway ahead of you. And plan on selling that thing on the upside of the next market cycle.
With being through the recession, in that down market, how were you, you know, able to get the debt for? Because I think a lot of people, you know, might be thinking, well, if I don't get something now when the market's down, you know, and that's the time to buy, how am I going to get a loan for it?
Right. Yeah, I hear you. The way I got loans back in the day was a lot of creative financing, honestly. My first 400 units was all seller financing, lease options, private equity, and I'd buy deals and then flip them into a bank loan. So you can do those sorts of creative financing when the market is soft and when we're in fully into a recession. But again, if you're in a down cycle and you're not getting creative financing, quality asset will usually still allow you to borrow. So that's that. It's not that the lenders stop lending and all the banks and all the lenders just go home for 3 or 4 years and do nothing. No, they still have to lend money. They still have to do business. They're just going to be very careful what they lend money on. That's why I say if you move towards quality assets, you open up a lot more opportunities for yourself as far as getting that debt and that loan is concerned. If you're looking at lesser assets, you know, something that's distressed, something that's an older building, and you're sort of in a down cycle, they're just going to give you less lender. It's just going to give you less loan to value. Instead of borrowing 80% of that purchase price, you're probably going to borrow 65 or 70%. Just means you're bringing more down payment to the deal, but that kind of gives you lesser returns. So, you know, that's the trick. Again, it just falls back to quality of asset.
So obviously with the title of the podcast, Apartment Investing for Early Retirement, what does the word retirement mean to you?
I'm dead. You're asking an entrepreneur what the word retire means? I have no clue. I don't know what to tell you, Derek. What would a general answer of retirement be? Gosh, I don't know. It sounds boring. I guess not having to buy apartments anymore. I don't know. I enjoy the business and I enjoy doing this. And so I can't really imagine not being in business in some respect. But I think for the average individual, retirement would be sort of having enough passive revenue that it exceeds your monthly expenses. I think that's what most people would probably consider retirement. And I can actually give you some math for that. A lot of times people they think about cash flow. And this is something I've noticed a lot of people get into the business. And they know how much cash flow they need. They never stop to think, what does it take to create that cash flow? So let me give you an example. For every 10, when I ask people, and I lecture and travel around the country speaking, and when I ask people, what is your monthly cash flow number? What's your monthly goal? The average answer, about $10,000 a month. Most people would say, hey, if I brought in $10,000 a month in passive revenue, I'd be pretty good. Or at least that would change my life. And so what I figured out is, okay, for every $10,000 in passive revenue you want to make, it's $1.5 million in equity at an 8% cash on cash. So what I'm saying is, for every $10,000 that you have a goal to make, that's not your goal. Your goal is to create $1.5 million worth of equity that's in a deal, producing that cash flow. See, a lot of people don't stop and think, where does cash flow come from? From equity. If you don't own a deal, if you don't have any equity in the deal, how are you going to get cash flow? You're not. So you think about, if you have $1.5 million and you park it in a deal and it's producing an 8% return, that's $120,000 a year. Divided by 12, 10 grand a month. So for every $10,000 a month you want, you really have a goal of creating $1.5 million in equity. Now, how do we create $1.5 million? Well, there's lots of ways of doing that. You can flip deals, you can wholesale, you can renovate and force value and refinance. I mean, there's a million ways to do it, but that's your real goal. If you're after cash flow, your real goal is the creation of $1.5 million in equity, however you do it. And so that can take a couple of years to get going.
Awesome. Yeah, because that's the thing is, what is it? Yeah, the end result, oh, it's this glamorous thing. Right. Okay, well, what do I need to do to get to that point? So that's... Right.
You can walk around any room and ask people, what do you want to make in cash flow? Almost anybody can tell you. And you say, great. What does it take to produce $10,000 a month cash flow? And their eyes are going to roll back there. They're going to have no clue. You know, and so $1.5 million, that's the answer.
Great insight. Thank you. Yeah, that's the thing is, it's not the end game or the end result. It's what does it take to get there? How do you make that happen?
No point in having a goal. You don't understand how to achieve the goal. Mm-hmm. That's not a goal. That's a wish. That's a dream. That's silly.
So was there one book thing that happened that made you take action to multifamily?
Oh, yeah, technically. It wasn't multifamily specifically, but I did read a book that motivated me to quit my job. Yeah, that was that sort of watershed event, I guess you could say, whatever you call it. Yeah, it was actually, oddly enough, Sun Tzu's The Art of War. You know, everybody always thinks it's going to be some kind of like, you know, real estate book or something or other. It wasn't. It was actually Sun Tzu's Art of War. The takeaway that I had from that book, and I was reading it when I still had a job, when I was sitting at my job, and basically short version, you know, he says, hey, when you're down to just a few troops, and if you haven't read that book, Sun Tzu, The Art of War, strongly recommend it, but read it in a business sense, not a military sense. And so what he says in that book is, hey, if you're down to just a few remaining soldiers, the best thing you can do is to march all your soldiers across the bridge into enemy territory, burn the bridge, and then tell your soldiers, that's the way home. You know, he says, if you burn the bridge and the soldiers have no way to go but forward through enemy territory, he said, your soldiers will fight like animals because they have no choice. And that's when I realized that, oh, my job is that bridge back to safe territory. And every time I get close to a deal or I look at a deal and I get a little nervous, I would run back across the bridge back to my job. So I realized for myself, being a relatively lazy individual that I am, I needed to figure out some way to commit myself. Because if I left myself alone, I was just going to do the lazy thing, which is go back to work. and just stay in my comfort zone. So after I read that passage, I thought, okay, I got to figure out what is my bridge, and then I have to burn my bridge so that I have no choice but to go forward and survive. And I realized my job was the bridge. So that's why I actually quit when I only had $10,000 a month, $300 cash flow. You know, by the way, I was 28 years old, single, no children, not married. You know, it's a lot easier for me to do that back then. I don't necessarily recommend everybody run out and quit their job with a duplex. But that was the sort of moment for me was when I read that book. That was my aha moment when I realized I was going to have to figure out some sort of higher level of commitment to push myself out of my comfort zone and get to work. And I did.
And it's worked out for you.
It's worked out for me. Yeah.
Learned a lot along the way, but
yeah, learned a lot along the way.
But it's worked out. Yeah, it's just getting uncomfortable, and it kind of forces you to take action. So
and that was it. I just needed something to push me out of the nest. I did. Yeah.
Great. So how can our listeners find out more about you?
Sure, you can reach us at BroadwellPropertyGroup.com. That's our website, or you can email me directly. It's Bill B-I-L-L. Ham at BPG, Broadwell Property Group, UBG.mail.com. Reach out to us.
That's all we have for today. So I want to just thank you. And
sure, my pleasure.
For coming on here. A lot of great information and a lot of, again, the real side of real estate. It's not all sunshine and rainbows.
Not always. Sometimes it is.
Yeah. Do what you can now, especially where we're at in the market cycle, to watch out and prevent disaster down the road.
Right.
So. Or do the best. I mean, everything is unforeseen. The whole world could end in theory, but you know, in terms of don't get yourself in trouble in real estate by taking that, having some good things to look out for. So certainly appreciate all that insight. Yeah. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Please like and leave a rating review for the show. With that, wish you a great rest of your week and take care.
We'll see you next time.